So this is our last Torah class for this year, except on the 28th, we're going to go through, for those of you who can come, we're going to go through theories of reading the Torah, because that's the morning before Shavuot. So, but this is, we're going to finish, and so next, we're going to finish now, and next year after the High Holidays, we're going to begin on chapter 32 of Genesis. So we're going to finish chapter 31 today. We'll begin on chapter 32, and then next year we'll finish up the Jacob story, God willing, and and start on the Joseph story. And we'll see where we get from there. So when last we left Jacob, Laban had run after him to either recover his daughters or recover his household gods, depending on your interpretation of Laban's behavior. But essentially, the story is that Jacob worked for Laban for 14 years, married his daughters, and then, because he either was afraid of Laban or was non-confrontational or was sneaky or thought that Laban would prevent him from leaving, he ran in the middle of the night with the daughters and left. Laban comes chasing after him. Jacob says, anybody that you find the idols with will not remain alive. Laban doesn't find anybody with the idols, but in fact, we know that Rachel has taken them. Laban says he searches everyone's tent before he searches Rachel's, thereby showing that he trusts most the one he should trust least. Rachel says, I have my period, so I can't get up. But in fact, she is sitting on the idols. Laban doesn't ask her to get up, and that's how she gets away with the theft. Now, according to Sarna makes a point in here that we didn't talk about. We basically came to the conclusion, which I still think is the reasonable conclusion, that Rachel took the idols because she thought they had power. The rabbis say that she took them to prevent her father from worshiping them, which is a generous interpretation of her behavior. But as Alter points out, if she really only wanted him to stop worshiping them, she would have dumped them somewhere, right? She wouldn't have kept them with her all this time. Sarna, who is defending the traditional interpretation, says that the fact that she's sitting on them when she's having her period implies an attitude of willful defilement and contemptuous rejection of the idea that these idols had any religious worth. So, but that implies that sort of double credulity. First of all, you have to believe that she actually did have her period and she wasn't lying to her father about it. And second, you have to believe that she was sitting on them with her period, not to hide them, but to show contempt for them. So all I can say is, you know, Sarna's commentary is often quite wonderful and quite critical and quite illuminating. In this case, I'm not sure that I buy it, but okay. Now we've come to Jacob's speech, which is chapter 31, verse 36. Now Jacob became incensed, that means angry, and took up his grievance with Laban. Now remember, he's never really yelled at Laban for everything that Laban has done for him. And now that Laban accused him, he thinks unjustly, because he also doesn't know that Rachel took the idols. It all comes out. What is my crime? What is my guilt that you should pursue me? You rummaged through all my things. What have you found of your household objects? See here, before my kinsmen and yours, let them decide between us two. So first of all, there is this theme of Jacob being a thief. Remember that. Jacob steals the brother's birthright. Then he doesn't steal, but he uses a kind of subterfuge to get Laban's property. Remember, he shows the sheep striped bits of bark and so on, and so as a result he becomes wealthy despite the fact that Laban was going to leave him relatively impoverished. So I guess Jacob is sick of being declared a thief. And finally he says, look, here are your kinsmen and mine. You tell the difference between us. Now, it's in the rabbis, in rabbinic literature, it is a great sin to embarrass someone in public. So I'm not going to say that this is Norm Pell's 86th birthday as he walks in, because to do so might embarrass him in public, and I wouldn't do such a thing. But et Sameach Yom Huled, et Sameach
Yom Huled,
et Sameach Yom Huled. Studying Torah keeps you young. That's all I can say. Happy birthday. So Jacob is particularly sensitive to, Jacob is particularly sensitive to the accusation that he's a thief, and says to Laban, look, your people and my people are here, so let them decide between us, and they can decide who's a thief. Look what he says in the next verse. These 20 years I've spent in your service, your ewes and she-goats never miscarried, nor did I feast on rams from your flock. In other words, I really was careful. I didn't take anything from you. You never had cause to be upset with me. That which was torn by beasts, I never brought to you. I guess the shepherd is responsible for anything that gets, torn by beasts. So also, by the way, of course, presages Jacob. Joseph. Remember when they bring the coat and they say he was torn by beasts. Jacob says, that which was torn by beasts I never brought to you. The brothers, of course, will bring to him that which is torn by beasts, even though it's not really. Okay? I myself made good the loss. You exacted it of me, whether snatched by day or snatched by night. In other words, you weren't so generous with me, despite the fact that I never cheated you. And you can hear, you know how this is like a marital fight. You know how when the floodgates open, and 30 years ago, and then 20 years ago, and 10 years ago, it's like he brings up everything that over the years has been eating away at him because he never had the freedom to do that before. Jacob was his employer. This is the exit interview, right? So he can tell him all the things that bothered him all those years. What's that?
Did you say Jacob was his employer?
Laban was Jacob's employer.
Yeah.
Often scorching heat ravaged me by day and frost by night, and sleep fled from my eyes. Of the 20 years I spent in your household, I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks. Okay, so that's not just for the daughters, but also to earn the money. And you changed my wages time and again. Had not the God of my father, the God of Abraham and Pachad Yitzchak, the fear of Isaac, we'll come back to that in a second, been with me, you would have sent me away empty-handed. But God took notice of my plight and the toil of my hands and gave me judgment last night. Now, why last night? Because remember, if you turn back to verse 29, this is Laban speaking to Jacob. I have it in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father said to me last night, beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad. That's why he's Pachad Yitzchak. The God of your father put the fear of God into me, right? Now, you could also say he's Pachad Yitzchak because of the Akedah, right? The fear of Isaac because of the binding of Isaac when God tells Abraham to take Isaac up on the altar and Isaac is almost killed. But clearly, Isaac has some relation to the aspect of God that is fearsome. And Jacob feels protected by that fearsome God. And so Laban, despite the fact that Jacob knows that Laban would have tried to do something to him again, Laban doesn't, precisely because the God of Isaac, the fear of Isaac, prevented him from doing so. So this is Jacob's speech. He begins, I just want to take a quick note of the speech. He begins by saying, I'm innocent, right? Begins by saying, you rummaged through everything, you didn't find anything, I'm completely innocent. He goes on to say, I worked for you all these years and you cheated me badly. Cheated me, so it's a perfect Freudian slip. You treated me badly. And then he ends up by saying, and you would have continued to treat me badly were it not for the fact that God was protecting me. So that's the structure of the speech. And also, of course, it recalls to us God saying to Jacob, I will watch out for you. And here Jacob is acknowledging that, in fact, God is watching out for him and protecting him from Laban, as God will watch out for him shortly and protect him from Esav. Okay? Laban spoke and said to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, all that you see is mine. Okay, now this reminds us of the in Pirkei Avot, they say that the midah, the way of a normal person is to say what's yours is yours and what's mine is mine. The way of a tzaddik, the way of a righteous person is to say what's yours is yours and what's mine is yours. And midat Sodom, the way of Sodom is to say what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine. And this is exactly what Lavan, I mean, this is Jacob's, he worked with him for 20 years. But for Lavan, the daughters are my daughters and the flocks are my flocks. You may have temporary custody of them, right? But in fact, he still sees them as his own. And that tells you everything you need to know about Lavan. And also sort of retrospectively justifies Jacob's fleeing in the middle of the night. Because if that's Lavan's attitude, the chances are he never would have let him go had he not. So he goes on and says, yet what can I do now about my daughters or the children they've borne? He doesn't even say about the sheep, right? It's like they still belong to him. He can't quite let them go, which may also say something about his priorities. Okay, so you got the kids, right? And we all know that, in fact, that that's true, that there are people who in their actions, even if they're not in their words, hold their possessions more dearly than they hold their family, right? So for Lavan, losing his daughters, it's not good. You shouldn't lose your daughters, but all right, but my sheep, which is another way of saying my wealth, right? My wealth, that kills him that Jacob got his wealth, right? Come then, let us make a pact, you and I, that there may be witnesses between you and me. Thereupon Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. So they took stones and made a mound, and they partook there of a meal by the mound. Lavan named it Yagar Sahaduta, but Jacob named it Gilad. And Lavan declared, this mound is a witness between you and me this day. That's why it was Gilad, and it was called Mitzpah, because they said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we're out of sight of each other. Now, I just want to tell you, there are two stone markers, two meals, two place names. God is mentioned twice, and by two separate names. Okay, so this is clearly the structure of the way the Torah puts it together shows you that it's a pact between two different people, both of them joined in this two-ness, okay? Moreover, the pact contains two provisions, one dealing with family matters, the other of a political nature. The first seeks to protect the interests of Lavan's two daughters in a foreign land, and the second delineates the boundaries between two ethnic groups. Now, I'll come to that in a second. What does the pact say? Verse 50. If you ill-treat my daughters or take other wives besides my daughters, though no one else be about, remember God himself will be a witness between you and me. Now, what does it mean, ill-treat my daughters or take other wives? According to the rabbis, ill-treat, and this is really interesting, since he says, or take other wives, they assume ill-treatment means, anyone want to guess? What's that? Not having sexual relationships. Withdrawing conjugal rights from the wife is ill-treating them, which is a really interesting conclusion for the rabbis to draw, because, of course, the conventional wisdom is that the man wants conjugal relationships and the woman doesn't. The rabbis reverse that, which is also reversed in the ketubah, you know, that the man owes his wife conjugal relations in the ketubah. And here they're saying that's Jacob's way of ill-treating, also probably because there was all this about who had children, you know. Who, remember, Rachel with the mandrakes, she's going to sleep with me tonight instead of sleeping with you. That was part of it as well. And then he says the second half of the pact, and Lavan said to Jacob, here's this mound and here's the pillar which I've set up between you and me. This mound shall be a witness, and this pillar shall be a witness, that I'm not to cross to you past this mound, and you're not cross to me past this mound and this pillar with hostile intent. In other words, not that you can't walk on the land, but you can't, I'm not to come to you to take anything or you to me. May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, their ancestral deities, judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Jacob then offered a sacrifice on the height and invited kinsmen to partake of the meal. After the meal, they spent the night on the height. Now, anybody know what people Lavan is the ancestor of? Of Aram, the Arameans, okay? Remember, Arami Aveda V, my father was a wandering Aramean? That's half of the rabbis take that to be Lavan. Okay, some take it to be Jacob, but that's a separate argument that we don't need to get into. But the point is here, if you're looking at the Torah, not only as a story of individuals, but the story of nations, this is the pact of peace between the Arameans and the Israelites. Because nobody is just themselves in the Torah. Nobody's just themselves, right? Everybody represents something greater than themselves, and later generations saw all these people as representing a people, not just a person, right? That's why Yishmael became the first Rome and then the Arabs and so on. They always represent someone. Lavan represents the Arameans who aren't alive today, obviously, but were a big factor in the ancient Near East. And this is the pact of peace between them, which according to some commentators, it shows the antiquity, the oldness of this section of the Torah, that pact between the Arameans and the Israelites had to be quite old, since after all the Arameans disappeared from the scene. By the time of David, I don't think there were any Arameans, so that was in the patriarchal times. So what you have here is a dividing up, a sort of pruning of the Israelite tree, right? Jacob is now going to be, we don't really know what part Lavan is going to play in the future of the Israelites when Jacob goes to Lavan's house and he marries his daughters. But Lavan separates himself in two different ways from the future of Israel. First of all, from the pact, that is, you go your way, I'll go mine, and also by his declaration to the god Nahor, right? Jacob, notice, swears by the god of Israel, by Pachad Yitzchak, by the god of his father, but Lavan swears by the god of Nahor, which is his way of saying that I continue to separate myself from you religiously as well as politically. Also, to the end of the story, Jacob apparently never finds out that Rachel has the idols. And we don't hear any more about the idols. So what becomes of the idols? I don't know. We can speculate, but whatever conclusion we come to, it's what matters, of course, is that Rachel's children, who are Joseph and Benjamin, will follow the way of their father and not the way of their grandfather. So it's a very, I would say that it's a story that has a lot of complicated, intertwined, both family and national history behind it. And it's one more stage in Israel removing itself from the nations around it. And for the first time, there are enough Israelites to start to constitute their own unit, right? Because before this, you just have Abraham and Sarah. Then you just have Isaac and Rebekah. Now you have Jacob and all of his children. So now we're starting to get the definition that will lead us then down into Egypt, of course, and then up into the book of Exodus. Okay, let's stop there for now and take questions on anything we've covered this whole year, because this is our chance. Yeah.
Just on this last point. So in Judaism, your religion is based on your mother. So in this situation, though,
Well, that doesn't start. The mother-father divide. The mother, the religion following the mother doesn't really start till the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay? Before that, with the exception, of course, of Sarah and Rebecca, of Sarah, because Abraham has other children, but only Sarah's child is Jewish. But apart from that, it follows the father because you come into the tribe of the father. It's at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah when their intermarriage started to proliferate and you needed to know who the child was a child of, and because you can't know who was the father, the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, the dictum came down that it follows the mother. But before that, in the Torah, it works like a tribal society, which is since the father has the tribe and the area, it goes with the father. Yeah.
I have two questions. One is about today. It says that Jacob said to his kinsmen, who were the kinsmen? I thought only his.
Whoever he took with him.
So
whoever. Men went with him. Whenever any of these guys travel, they always have a group of people who go with them, and they're sort of traveling troop. Don't forget that when Jacob meets Esau, he divides people into two camps. When Abraham goes, he takes 200 souls, right? Anefashot asher asu b'charan. So what the rabbis assume is that Abraham converts all the people in his party and makes them part of his religious tradition, the same with Jacob.
So is it possible that when Jacob says, Laban says, my sons, and at the end says, let me kiss my son and my daughters, is it possible that some of the sons went with Jacob?
It's possible. I mean, I suppose. I would think that they would tell us if they did, but I suppose it's possible. Yeah. It's a good question, but save it for the next class, because we're going to talk about different ways of reading the Torah. So, the 28th, the last class for Shavuot, because, well, we'll talk about it then. Yeah. Yes.
Based on your question, what is the ruling now? Is it based on being Jewish because of your mother, your father, or now it's both? Either way, you could be.
So this is the way it works today. According to the Orthodox and conservative movements, and traditionally for Jews up until the 20th century, and I'll talk about it in a second, it follows the mother. If you have a Jewish mother, you're Jewish, doesn't matter who your father is. It doesn't matter how Jewish your father is. If your mother is not Jewish, then you're not Jewish. Okay? This sometimes has complications. I was once asked to do a wedding, for example, for a woman whose mother converted but was Jewish. She converted to Christianity, but then the daughter, before her daughter was born. So the question is the daughter Jewish? Because strictly speaking, according to the Jewish law, even if you convert, you're still considered Jewish. But on the other hand, she wasn't Jewish. So do I do the, it turns out that in the end, I couldn't do the wedding anyway, but what I, in consultation with several rabbis whom I kicked this around with, I was going to ask the bride to go to the mikveh. And that would sort of, you know, just by going to the mikveh, and especially if you said the blessing for Geirut, for conversion, which you could or couldn't do, then there was a difference of opinion, then she would be considered Jewish. So it gets complicated, but it's fairly clear. Now, about, I don't remember, sometime in the 1980s, I think, the Reform movement made a change in that. And they, because what they said was, in modern America, what happens sometimes is you have two couples. One couple is, the mother is Jewish, but they send their kid to the Episcopal school, the kid's not raised in a Jewish home, they have no Jewish identity, and yet they would be considered Jewish by traditional standards. The other couple, the mother definitionally isn't Jewish, she never converted, the father's Jewish, they raised their kid as Jews, and yet they're not considered Jewish. So they decided on what's called patrilineal descent, which means either, I'm about to argue against this, by the way, but this is what the Reform Movement, and I'll tell you why in a second. But the Reform Movement said either parent being Jewish, if the child is raised as a Jew, they're to be considered Jewish. Okay. The other reason that they did that was that what would happen, and happens to me from time to time, is someone would come into your office, having been raised as a Jew, having thought of themselves as a Jew, only to have the rabbi say to them, by the way, you're not Jewish, you have to go to the mikveh, because your mother's not Jewish, and that would be a tremendous insult. The reason that I understand why they did the patrilineal descent, the reason why I object to it is twofold. One is that it changed Judaism from a family to a religion. It no longer mattered how you were born, it mattered how you were raised and taught. And Judaism traditionally wasn't that way. Judaism traditionally was not a function, how good a Jew you were might be how you were taught or practiced. But you were a Jew definitionally because you were born into the family, and that was just it. And if you were born into the family, you were. And if you weren't, then you had to join the family. And that changed radically, I think, the nature of the way we look at Judaism. And the other problem is, I understand that it's insulting to someone, but it's also a very easy fix to ask someone to go to a mikveh and say a blessing. And it seems to me to make a huge change for the feelings of those people is a shame, because it created really a giant divide. I mean, I have a problem now if someone comes to me and they say that I'm Jewish, I was raised in a Reformed temple, and I say to them, well, was your mother Jewish? And they say no, right? That's a hard thing for me, so then I have to ask them to convert. And you know, their entire life, they were in a Reformed synagogue down the street and considered themselves Jewish, and now I'm saying to them, no, you have to go to the mikveh, and the first thing that they'll say to me is, does that mean that you don't consider me Jewish? And that's very hard. Yes?
Are you saying if one goes to mikveh, then they become Jew? I'm not sure. I'm not clear.
They need to convert. That's for a woman or for a man, that's an essential stage in the conversion.
Oh, okay.
That's how you convert, is by going to the mikveh. You convert by a course of study, but presuming that somebody has already studied, then they go to the mikveh, but there's a special blessing that you say you go to the mikveh for the purpose of conversion. And the trickier one is that if you're a man, you're supposed to do what's called hatafat dam brit, which means extracting a drop of blood from your penis, which is apparently not painful, and you do it to yourself, but is obviously, you know, it's hard for people to come to grips with, right? Some people say that you can convert without it. That's also a controversy, but the standard idea is that you have to do that. It's a symbolic conversion. This is if you've already been circumcised. If you haven't been circumcised, then you have to be circumcised, which also for adult males is, you know, no picnic. I've been told. Because it's a symbolic circumcision, and you don't get circumcised on your finger, alas. Yeah. Although, you know, yes. In what sense?
What was the question?
About the lineage of Kohanim. It derives from the father, but also there is something called a bat kohen, which is the daughter of a kohen. So, yeah, that's true. But the Kohanim were the priests that served in the temple. The lineage, again, that lineage is less, I mean, traditionally a kohen couldn't marry a divorcee, and a kohen couldn't marry a convert, but that's almost universally not observed in conservative and reform, but is in orthodoxy. Right. Yeah.
Is it someone that converts to Judaism, are they considered a Jew because they just converted, or the act of simply going to a mikveh and a mikveh, or is it that they're actually changing their soul by going to a mikveh?
Okay, so here's what I would say. We may have a dispute about this, but I don't believe that the souls of Jews are any different than the souls of anyone else, and therefore I don't think they're changing their soul. I just reviewed for the Jewish Journal a couple of weeks ago, I reviewed a new edition of the Kuzari. The Kuzari is a work of medieval Jewish philosophy from Yehuda Halevi, who's the one who really started this whole business about Jewish souls being different. Yehuda Halevi was a great man and a great thinker, but he also lived in the Middle Ages, and he lived at a time of oppression, and this was a sort of spiritual revenge. The Kabbalistic Yehuda Halevi-ish idea, which, by the way, you'll find in Chabad will tell you that Jewish souls are different. Not better, they will say, just different. But I think that that's an idea that Jews ought to get past. It's frankly what Harold Schulweis, and I agree with him, calls metaphysical racism. I don't believe that Jewish souls are different from this. I don't think the difference is in the hardware, the difference is in the software. That is, it's Judaism that makes people different. It's not that Jews are different. So as far as I'm concerned, when someone accepts Judaism, they are as Jewish. In fact, according to Maimonides, do you know the famous letter of Maimonides to Ovadia the convert? It's a beautiful letter. Ovadia, who is a convert, writes to Maimonides. Now remember, Maimonides is the greatest single authority in the history of the Jewish tradition, okay? He writes to Maimonides and he says, how can I say the God of my ancestors, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? So they're not the God of my ancestors. And Maimonides writes back to him and says, in some ways you have a greater right to say this than someone who was born Jewish, because you chose to be part of this tradition, whereas other people were born into it, and they get no credit for being born into it, but you, despite the fact that you know that it's a difficult tradition and it has a history of persecution, you chose to do it, so you absolutely should say that. Now, Maimonides doesn't say your soul changed. And so I think, you know, there are practical difficulties with marrying someone who converts. The practical difficulties are the families, right? It's hard to have your child go to a family where you know that they're not, you know, they don't share the same concerns that you do, where maybe they celebrate Christmas or where they're upset that they can't go, you know, to church on Easter or whatever. There are practical difficulties. But in terms of the person, him or herself, I think that it's not only is conversion legitimate, but it's crucial for a Jewish community that wants to keep itself in America in the 21st century. Because a lot of Jews will marry non-Jews. And if we let them know that conversion is looked down upon, then we destroy the motivation for the people they marry to join us. And that's not in our interest. So, yeah.
For those who say that Jewish souls are different, how do they say they are different? In what ways?
Well, the most gentle way of saying that they're different is only Jewish souls are capable of prophecy. But since prophecy is no longer an issue, it's not an issue. But, you know, they're spiritually more attuned in one way or another. Better. I mean, they wouldn't say better, I don't think. But I don't know. Ask your local Chabad rabbi what he thinks. I'm not being facetious. I'm serious. Ask him. Do you think that Jewish souls are different from non-Jewish souls? And if so, how? And you'll get your answer.
When you're selling or buying an item, you have to use exactly the same weight. And then they say, oh, so you can use two different weights. You can use a 1 pound that's a little bit more than a pound.
But that's exactly the opposite of what the Talmud says.
I know, but...
The Torah says explicitly that you have to use weights that are not...
But when it says explicitly to do that, it says, then it brings to your mind, I mean, that's what they say.
That's like saying when you say be honest to someone, it brings to your mind you should be dishonest.
But you see that a lot.
There's a name actually for that kind of reasoning. It's called anti-Semitism. It's what it is. I mean, you know, come on. It's, yeah. So I don't buy it. Yeah. 1, 2, 3.
With respect to a woman being Jewish, a man being non-Jew.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you personally have a problem with that?
Well, it depends what you mean by a problem with it. I think that it's better to have both parents of the same faith, but I always tell couples that they should choose a faith. Even if they're of two different faiths, they should choose a faith, whatever it is, and raise the child in that faith consistently. And usually, the mother's faith is the one that in studies, the mother's faith is determinative. Even if you have two Jewish parents and the mother is more or less religious, the child usually ends up to be the way the mother is, more than the father.
This is my second marriage. My first husband was very religious.
Mm-hmm. That I have a problem with it too, but I don't. No, seriously. But I don't want to. I don't want to make that the subject. We could talk about that all day.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying,
yeah.
To me, it doesn't make a person.
Well, it's not an issue. You know, I get this often. It's not an issue of how good the person is. It's an issue of whether the tradition can be transmitted. That is, somebody can marry someone who's a wonderful person. That doesn't mean that Judaism will get. I had this conversation yesterday. In fact, just yesterday. Someone said they married someone who isn't Jewish. They have a child. The parents are treating him badly in her mind. I mean, she may well be right. I'm just saying I've only heard her side of it. Parents are treating him badly. And she learned that Judaism was all about accepting people. So I said to her, look, I don't think that they should treat him badly. He did nothing wrong. He married you. I mean, it wasn't his, you know. I think that I said, you all have to get, you have to draw very clear lines about what is, what everybody is in this. I said, but don't misrepresent the tradition because of what you did. You made a choice, and that's okay, that's your choice, but that doesn't change Judaism. Judaism actually isn't about accepting everything that everyone does. Judaism is about treating all human beings well, but also about transmitting the tradition. And the reason that your parents feel this way is Judaism does put a very strong emphasis on marrying Jews, and you know that. You chose not to do it, but that doesn't mean that you can then turn around and say, well, Judaism doesn't care about that. You have to accept the consequences of what you do, and your parents have to accept the consequences of what they do. You just have to be honest about it. So what my argument is against people assuming that systems have to change because of the choices that they make. I feel that way about, Catholics aren't allowed to say, I'm pro-abortion and pro-gay marriage, but I'm actually a good Catholic. You have to say, look, I'm outside the system. I think the system is wrong. The system shouldn't do this, but as the system exists, I stand outside it. You're allowed to say that, but that doesn't mean that you can say the system is now different from what it really is because I make a different choice. And Jews have to acknowledge the same thing. Yeah.
So I'd like to go back to Jacob.
Who's that? Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about his life in terms of character development.
We will. Actually, at the end, I'm going to save that. There's a long arc of character development, but I want to save it till after the encounter with the angel, and then we're going to talk about the whole. We're sort of, even though we're at the end of the year, we're not at the end of Jacob's story in some sense. So if you want to make an observation, that's fine, but I actually don't want to talk about it yet.
Well, it seems to me that, he grew up in tents and listening to what his mom told him to do. And since then, there have been different steps along the way, teaching him how to stand on his own two feet. Mm-hmm. And now here he's confronted and that's another step in his development.
Right, I think that's true. But I'm going to leave it at that for the moment. So there was one who, go ahead, yeah.
Frequently, I think, you have referred to the rabbis as
yes.
Talmud.
The rabbis of the Talmud.
I'd like to, can you just, def- and then.
Okay, I don't want to go into this in too much detail because I've done this actually a couple times and I may do it again next year. I've gone through the chronology of Jewish history and who the rabbis are, but they're the rabbis of the Talmud from 50 BCE until about 600 or 700 CE in Babylonia and in Israel. So when you hear the rabbis or the rabbis of the Talmud, those are the rabbis we're talking about. It includes Hillel, Akiba, Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the rabbis of the Haggadah that you read about. Those are the rabbis, essentially, basically, that we're talking about. When someone is after that, they're usually identified as being medieval or later. The Gaonim and what are called the Rishonim and the Achronim, the Rishonim are the first ones and the Achronim are the later ones. They're all post all of that group. Rashi, Rambam, all of them are post-Talmudic. So there's the rabbis of the Talmud, then there's the post-Talmudic rabbis, and then modernity. But that's a very quick resume. Yeah.
Can I go back to intermarriage for 1 second?
Sure.
What do you say to the guy and his girlfriend who come to you and say, we want to be married by a rabbi, but the girl's not Jewish, or one of them isn't Jewish? What do you tell them?
I tell them that there are rabbis who will marry them, but I won't. And I tell them why I won't. There are two reasons I won't. The first reason I won't is because my marriage is a Jewish legal ceremony and it doesn't apply to someone who isn't Jewish, so it's a travesty of the ceremony. The second reason I won't is because to the extent that you can define my overall task, it is to try to ensure the continuity of the Jewish people and the Jewish tradition. Since intermarriage, however kind and loving the people involved, is a serious threat to that continuity. For me to preside over it is for me to deliberately participate in something that's destructive of that which I've given my life to uphold. So they're asking me to contravene my own principles to do that.
And the rabbis that do marry them, I mean, I always assume they operated on the inclusive factor where
they did. They do.
And that's, but you just have to get some other rabbi. In other words, it's not right. Going to be you, but it would be right. Someone who
right, someone who believes that actually that is, putting the best face on it, someone who believes that actually that ultimately is good for the Jewish people. I don't believe it. Yeah.
Where does that concept of get and divorce come from?
Get comes from the Torah itself, that it says when you send your wife away, you give her get kritut, a document of separation, and then the rabbis elaborate that. It's to protect, no, it's not to make it more difficult, although that's how the law has evolved. It's to protect the couple so that there's, so that someone doesn't become a serial marrier, so that it's clear that you can prove that in fact you were divorced before you get married again. And also to make divorce a little bit more difficult because they didn't want it to be too easy. You know, and we never, Judaism was never like the Catholic Church, never forbade divorce. Always thought that divorce was appropriate under some circumstances, but I think it didn't want to make divorce, you know, automatic. Yeah.
Will you marry someone, a Jewish woman and man, if one of them did, if they had been divorced and did not get a get?
No, have to get a get, but that's easily done. It's easily done.
Expensive.
Depends who you do it with.
Well,
it's not necessarily.
You go in front of the Beit Din.
No, but it depends on the Beit Din.
It's not expensive.
No, you can do it for. But yeah, go ahead.
The Pasha's the genealogy of Judaism. I was curious, statistically, do you find that most people who decide to convert, it comes at the time when they want to marry somebody?
Most people.
Great majority, or do you find where...
Most people, but I think that's the best reason to convert. I have a sermon about this that if anybody wants, I'm happy to just ask Rebecca about it. The best reason, if somebody comes to me and says, I read Maimonides and I want to convert, I get worried because next week, right, they may, you know, read Aquinas, I don't know, and convert back. But if someone says I want to get married, what they're saying is I'm joining a family and I want to create a family. And the network of family and community is a much greater assurance that someone will stay Jewish than if someone lives alone or is getting converted when the rest of their family isn't converted. I've had people convert. Their husband or wife isn't converting and their children aren't converting, but they really feel called to Judaism. It's a beautiful, wonderful thing, but I'd feel much better if they were converting to marry. And I cannot tell you how many times I've sent a couple to the class at the American Jewish University, the Introduction to Judaism class, and I always ask both of them to go. And the Jewish person learns as much as the non-Jewish person because the last time they learned anything about Judaism was when they were 13. So, if it's a family and a network, I think that's a great reason. And I know that people commonly say that you shouldn't convert to marry. But by the way, and this is part of what the sermon is about, the great example of conversion in the Bible is who? And that's why she converts, to join a family. She converts because she wants to be part of Naomi's family. And she gets married to a Jewish man. And she was, remember, she was married to Naomi's son who dies. And she hadn't converted yet. So she finally converts to really be part of the family. And that's, so I think that it's a great reason to convert. It's hard on the family. I know that it's hard on the family, but.
If a woman is Jewish and a man is not, will you marry them?
No.
No.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's rare in the Bible. Yeah. Well, I agree. It is something amazing and unusual. And we have it, for example, with Abraham and his negotiations with Ephron the Hittite over the Ma'arat HaMachpelah. I think this goes back actually to Miriam's question before. I think there's an emphasis in the Torah about the legitimacy of business dealings. And you have to be scrupulous about them. And that's what Jacob is saying, is I have taken nothing from you that I shouldn't have taken. And also, I really do think, this is one of the ways that I'm going to talk about people read the Torah. They read, and in fact, you see this even today, right? When Jews and Muslims in the Middle East read the stories of the Torah, the stories of the Quran, as telling the story of how Jews and Muslims separated from each other, okay? That's what they're doing. An Aramean or an Israelite who read this story was reading it to see how the Arameans and the Israelites separated from each other, because that's how Lavan. So they might read this and say, ah, it's clear from this story you're allowed to go into my territory, but you promise not to attack us. So we will allow you to go into this area as long as you don't bring any armed men, because that's what it says right in the story. So I think also there's a level of detail because it mattered diplomatically and politically as well as religiously. But also I think it's a stage in the development of Jacob and therefore a stage in the development of Israel, and was elaborated for that reason. Having said that, it's sometimes very hard to know why the Torah is so full in some areas and so sparse in others. Why do we have so little about Isaac? So if you want to take a very modern critical approach, you can say some stories got preserved better than others. And some scholars even speculate that there were stories about Isaac that just didn't, for whatever reason, didn't make it into the Torah. Because remember that we have stories of the Midrash, and there are also, which some people don't realize, there are books that were written around the time that, or shortly after the Torah was codified, that we have that aren't in the Torah, right? The Book of Jubilees and the Book of Maccabees, for example, is not in the Torah. The story about the Maccabees isn't in the Torah. It's a book outside the Torah that we have that was written by ancient Jews, the story of Tobit, right? The story of Judith. These are all stories that were written by Jews, faithful Jews, at the time that were not considered sacred literature, so they aren't in the Torah, but they're still stories about things that happened to, so were there stories about Isaac that we don't have? It's possible. Why we don't have them, you can have your choice. We don't have them either because of accidents of transmission, or the stories weren't that powerful, or they weren't that popular, or because God chose not to transmit those stories to the people Israel, right? Either explanation works. Just depends which one you choose to accept, or some combination thereof. Yeah.
So the whole idea of the mounds and the stones is reminiscent of when, before he gets to Lavan's, and he puts
right.
The stone there. Is it there as a reminder? I mean, was that sort of a traditional thing? You build.
It's a traditional thing to do. Remember when Joshua goes into the land, they do that as well. They build a mound. When you make a pact, when you, I'm trying to think of what an equivalent is. It's like carving your initials in a tree. I mean, you make a visible sign of, it reminds me, I wrote in one of my off the pulpits, I wrote about carving your initials in the tree and how they, you know, you go back and they grow up over the year, and somebody wrote me and said, you know, Rabbi, you may not know this, but actually trees grow from the top, and if you carve your initials in the tree, they'll stay at the exact same spot where you carved them. I wrote back basically, oops, you know. It reminded me, what I wrote back was, there's this great quote from Samuel Johnson. Samuel Johnson, you know, was the first great compiler of the first English dictionary, and he wrote almost all the definitions by himself, and it's an extraordinary labor. It took the French Academy 20 years and a team of scholars to do what he did single-handedly in English. But he misdefined some part of a horse. I don't remember what it was. And a woman came up to him once and said, you know, Professor Johnson, you called this part of the horse this, and in fact it should be that, and I wonder, what explanation do you give for that? And he said, ignorance, madam, pure ignorance. So I wrote back and I said, you know, about how trees grow. But the same thing with the mound of... this was to mark the place where especially a pact took place, and it was supposed to stay forever, although obviously, you know, it doesn't, because that was the most permanent mark that ancient people could make.
But what about the idea that God is there, that the stone?
Well, it's like an altar, yeah. A stone is also an altar, and I think and in fact, what is forbidden in the Torah is an Asherah, which is a sacred pillar. So my guess is that was an ancient pagan practice that was used for a while, but then eventually the God of Israel said, I'm not represented by stone pillars, because people start to worship the pillar rather than, as is the sort of natural tendency. I mean, look, let's be honest, okay? The tape is still on, but let's be honest. You go to the wall in Israel, and it looks like people are praying to stones, you know? And if you don't have an understanding of what's going on, it also feels sometimes when you pray there like you're actually praying to the stones. And it's a very powerful thing to have something that you can touch and feel and so on. So you know that Judaism is always combating the sort of natural human tendency to worship things. And the wall is a kind of good example of that, despite the fact that I have to say, I mean, when I never go to Israel without going to the wall, I'm very moved every time I pray at the wall. And I really love to pray at the wall. And yet I do know that there's something suspect about it. Just like Alex Farkas of blessed memory, who was a wonderful member of our congregation. He got so upset every Shabbos. He always used to say something to me when the cantor would hold the Torah up like this. Because he would say, you're not supposed to worship the Torah. He says, you worship God, not the Torah. And when the cantor holds the Torah up like this, he says, I feel like we're all worshiping the Torah and I don't like it. And I would acknowledge his point every week, but, you know, we still, so there is that side. And I think that the mounds and so on that, you know, it speaks to us. And you do see when you carry the Torah around, the reverence that people show the Torah is almost idolatrous, you know?
So,
what's that?
A mezuzah.
A mezuzah, right, all those things. So, yeah.
What you just defined is why Abraham was my hero, because he didn't have to touch anything.
Right.
His father was an idol maker.
He said, that's why Abraham is my hero, because he made that leap.
And he
made that leap from the idol maker father to the very difficult. By the way, the other tradition that does this is Islam, which is very strict about, you know, doesn't even allow images, only geometrical shapes, which isn't true of Israel. If you go to the synagogues in ancient Israel, you know, you see zodiac signs on the floor, right? There was no real prohibition against having figures. There was just a prohibition against worshiping them. But that's why medieval Jews who lived in Islamic countries sort of thought of Christianity as idolatry. You can understand why, because you walk into a church and there's a statue. And they thought, no, come on, right? This is idolatry, yeah. Time to gather stones together. Maybe. That may be a reference to this. It's very possible. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of interpretations of that verse. But yeah.
So if you wandered around the area, you'd see these mounds of stones
Yep. Here
and there in the next place. And could you tell which religion or which group?
That's a great question. And I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I don't know if different groups collected stones differently or mounded them differently or so on. I don't know. Yeah.
On one of our trips to Israel, we went to Har Karkon, mm-hmm. and there are stones there. And because of that, they say that
it was
that this could be the sign. This could be Sinai, as opposed
right.
to in Egypt.
Well,
and
yeah.
It's amazing to see.
It is amazing when you go to. I mean, we were in Ireland this past summer, and I can't remember the name of the site, but there's a site that has stones that are older than Stonehenge, and they just sit there in this circle, and they don't know exactly what it was or how they did it or who did it, but there are these giant stones, and you feel that clearly for a long time was a place of reverence. I mean, you just feel it, that the way they were arranged and that thousands of years they're still there, it's very moving. As Stonehenge is very moving, just to think that people, you know, created these sites thousands of years ago to worship. So. It's one of those questions as to whether, because sacred sites tend to get built on other sacred sites, whether there are certain places in the world that draw, you know, greater sanctity, kind of like the Hollywood Bowl. Yeah.
Mama Leibowitz makes a distinction between pillars and altars.
Yeah.
She says one big distinction is anointing the altar
with oil. Which makes it to God, yeah. I like that, thank you. Okay, last question.
I was struck by the family discussion about conversion and then the talk about Jacob's character as a leader, but there's also Rachel's character and Leah's character, and the thing about the idol with Rachel, and yet she's become the one who reached the Lord.
Right.
The containing of the dissension within the family versus in the other stories, one of the children is
This is a nice point. Yeah, we gave Rachel a lot of attention last week, but it or 2 weeks ago, whenever the class was. But it is worth noting, as you say, that whereas other times the differences in the family tore them apart, that Rachel manages, as you say, to contain whatever dissension there is. She's sitting on the idols, but she still remains part of the Jewish tradition and gives birth, obviously, to Joseph and Benjamin. But as I said, we gave a lot of attention to Rachel's action last time and still didn't come to any good conclusion. But it's a very complicated question. What I want to do on the 28th before Dalia makes her announcement is talk about ways in which scholars traditionally and modern times read the Torah and just give you some alternatives to read it if you have a chance to read over the summer in preparation for next year. Okay, go ahead.